Hey,
Yeah.
welcome back to another episode of Social Echoes from True Voice Media. My name is John Steyer. I'm the host of Social Echoes and all accompanying projects and so forth and so on. Today we have Ted Rubin on the podcast. I'm very excited to have him in. How are you doing today, Ted?
I'm doing great. Really happy to be here.
Now, I'm thrilled that it's, I guess you, because you called me about 10 minutes before we went on the air, and you said you just gotten back from a run. So I'm assuming in New York State, it's, I guess for you, Long Island, the weather's pretty nice up there. It's finally starting to become springtime again.
You know, finally, but what they're saying is it's going to be nice today and tomorrow, and then it's going back into the 50s. I've had it. I'm leaving for Miami tomorrow.
Yeah, there you go.
There's fortunately, the Hispanicized Conference starts tomorrow in Miami until Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to be down in some I've had it with the winter. So I'm really excited to get out of here and be assured for some warmth.
Yeah, so what are you going to be doing down there? You're going to be speaking?
Yeah, I'm speaking at Hispanicize. I'm on a panel. It's an amazing conference. It's obviously targeted at the Hispanic Latino market. There's two major blogger conferences, Hispanicize and Latism. I've been fortunate enough to be speaking at both of them the last 2 years. Apparently, they really relate to my message of return and relationship, and their whole community is very relationship-based. So it's really great, and I'm doing a talk on Thursday about return and relationship and building advocacy.
Excellent. So I want to get to your new book, Return on Relationships, in a little bit. But your day job, you work for Collective Bias as the chief social marketing officer. And that's one of the first times I've heard somebody be the CSMO. Plenty of people having social duties as the CMO. How would you kind of say that you are different from a CMO?
Well, you know, the main reason I started using that title is I truly believe that you have to wrap a social shell around everything that we do these days, especially around marketing. But I think that you have to wrap a social shell around, in particular, marketing, customer service, any kind of consumer outreach, your employees, who should be your biggest advocate. So I thought social is a very important part of that title. And then beyond that, I focus more on the social aspects and a little bit less on your traditional CMO type of things. Basically, we are, you know, as a company, we are building our brand, but we're not a consumer packaged goods company. We're not out there making sure that every single person knows what we're all about. We're more about a social focus. And we also want to make sure that our company is a social company, because I see all these agencies, media companies, so-called gurus and experts out there preaching social, but then they're not actually social themselves. You know, they might have a social presence, but they rarely engage and interact, you know, unless you're at their quote-unquote level. And the companies themselves don't socialize internally. So we make a very big point of making sure that our whole company is social. And, you know, a few points about that is I'm wearing a Nike Fuel Band, okay? And one of the reasons I'm wearing a Nike Fuel Band is that we all wear them within the company. We call them our social health plan, because what happens is not only does it keep you personally aware of the activity and what you're doing every day, but we're all connected via that. We all check each other's. We're all connected socially that way. We push each other. We have fun with each other. So, you know, number one, it's a great way to stay healthy for yourself. Number two is it's a great way to stay healthy because you're connecting with others in a social aspect. So you know somebody's kind of watching you, and we all work a little bit harder when that happens. When I was out, I was actually doing a hike in a very steep area today, and I started speeding up when somebody was coming up behind me because I didn't want them to pass me. So even though I didn't know them. So when we're working with others that socially that way, it enhances it. And then as a company, it makes us all aware of what we're each doing every day. And another tool we use for that is something called PATH, you might be familiar with. So, you know, PATH has its limitations. I don't look at it as a great social platform that can really scale in a lot of areas. But what we love it is we use it as our company intranet. So everybody in the company is connected on PATH, and we all post photos where we're traveling, companies we're seeing, things we're doing with our families. And again, it makes us more of a social company. And I think that's very important for all companies, but especially companies that are particularly in the social space.
Yeah, that's fascinating. That's the first time I've ever heard anybody say that their business uses Path as kind of their intranet. That's really cool. And it's funny because I remember when Path first kind of became popular amongst my friends, you know, the first few months it was very interesting and people were using it. But every now and then I'll get a notification about Path, but it's the same thing that's being posted to Facebook or Twitter or Instagram maybe. And I think that's probably a really excellent way of using Path. Now, I guess you don't have how many people work for Collective Bias?
Right now, we are up to about 81, including contractors. So, we have somewhere in the neighborhood of 55 to 60 full-time employees. But I have to tell you, I agree with you. When I first got Path, I used it rarely. It's just another place you got to go, unless there's something of real true value there. Now, what I saw happening with our company is most people were using Path and they were ignoring Instagram. And I think that's a mistake from a social and an indexing point of view, because Path doesn't get you that kind of indexing. The stuff that goes on Instagram builds you a community, gets you outreach, you know, builds an audience in conjunction with a lot of other tools you're using. So what I do now is I post to Instagram first, and then I'll post to Path. But the reason I'm on Path all the time is I'm getting our company, we call it a family, and we try to stay very connected. And we want to think of what we're doing as a movement, as a cause, not as just a business. Because people work much harder for those kind of things. And one of the ways to do that is to make sure that we all know what each other is doing and get to participate in that. Some of us travel, some of us don't, you know, and it's been fabulous for us in that respect. So between you and me, I can't see Path surviving in the long term. I just hope they get bought by somebody that keeps the tool alive so that we can still keep using it, or somebody else gives us something like that. Because you can't do the same thing with Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, Instagram, because they're not insular enough. I know on Path, I'm not getting anything wasted. I go there, I see everything I want to see, and I don't miss anything from any of my coworkers or colleagues.
Yeah, I think I remember when, like I said, when Path first came out, Gary Vaynerchuk was very big on it, and he was talking a lot about Dunbar's number of 150. But again, it came down to functionality, and the functionality was already, you know, compatible with the networks that we were already using.
Right.
It's just tougher to get somebody onto another thing.
And here's where I take issue with Dunbar's number. I don't take issue with it as a fact of what we're capable of. What I take issue with is that number tends for me to shift every single day. It's not the same 150 people. So let's just say that number really is that number, whether it's 100, whether it's 25. I find that every different week, every different month, I interact more closely with different people. And then I shift back. So it moves. So I might be able to, let's say, only be able to manage that 150, but that 150 is constantly shifting throughout the 5, 10, 15,000 people that I might know through different things at different times, in different initiatives, in different conferences I'm going to, different people make up that 150.
Yeah, certainly. So one of the things too, you're very responsive on all your social networks. You've talked about it in a couple of different interviews before, but kind of quickly, how do you keep up with your own stuff? People, you know, myself, even today, I've tweeted back and forth with you a couple different times. The way that you got on this podcast was through Jeff Gibbard. He tweeted out to you, I think just kind of asking if you wanted to be on the podcast. And it's not even just the fact that you're responsive, because plenty of people are responsive, but you're so quick. How do you stay on top of all that stuff and maintain you know, just being able to work the way that you do? Like, how do you stay on top of everything?
It's not easy. I've got to tell you, you know, when you make part of your personal brand responsiveness, beware before you do it. But for me, it's second nature. It's who I am. So, I talk a lot about being authentic, and how when you're authentic, it's very easy to say what you're thinking, to remember what you said, because it's real. Well, I've always been very obsessive about communication, about getting back to people. So in some ways, it makes it hard. If I wasn't on social channels, I'd have a lot more time. You know, Seth Godin likes to say, when people ask him, how does he possibly produce so much content? He'll answer you straightforward and say, because he doesn't do a lot of other things. He will not take meetings. He will not go to lunch. He doesn't go out for breakfast. It's very difficult to get Seth out of his quote-unquote cave unless he's speaking somewhere. And when Seth speaks somewhere, watch him. He comes in, he's like a ninja. He comes in, he speaks, he leaves. If you get 15 minutes with him after that speech, you got a lot. You know, and I know Seth since 1997 when I started working with him at Yoyodyne, and I've been carrying a coin around in my pocket since we were bought by Yahoo when the time at Yoyodyne ended and he gave it out about the amazing thing we had done there. And I've got this great relationship with Seth. His quote is on the top of the back of my book. But getting him to take a meeting or to meet someone that I'd like him to see, nearly impossible. He has done it for me as a courtesy on occasion, but again, it's all about how you manage your time. So for me, I can't produce that kind of quantity of content because we all make choices. My choice is that my value, what I'm best at and what I'm happiest doing, is being in touch with people. So I take a lot of time for that. I take a lot of time for that in my job. Everybody in my company knows. Every once in a while, John Andrews, the co-founder of Collective Bias and my business partner, will, you know, say to me, like, you know, dude, what are you doing today? And I'm like, what do you think I'm doing? I'm communicating with everybody. I communicate with CEOs, CMOs. I communicate with bloggers. I communicate with mom and home. You reach out to me, I'll reach back. So yes, at certain times, I keep some of them quicker than others. I will rarely have a call as long as we might have on this thing. But to me, the beauty of this is I'm scaling communication here and relationships because I'm reaching out to all the people that you communicate with. And what I like to also talk about is how when you communicate with one and build a relationship, you're many are vicariously participating in the same way. So when companies say, how can you possibly scale relationships? We can't answer everybody. Well, guess what? I don't care how many millions of customers you have. Most of them don't want to speak to you on social. Most of them are not going to leave comments on your Facebook page. They're not going to tweet at you, but they are going to read other people's tweets. They're going to read other people's posts. They're going to know their friends spoke to you. And remember, word of mouth is not just social platforms. Social platforms exist everywhere we go. I'm going to a track meet to see my daughter play. That's a social platform. There'll be other parents there. Things I say to them will be passed on to other people. Traditional word of mouth is just that much more powerful now because when I am at the track meet and I mention something to a parent, they might go home and get on their social network and spread it that much faster than they would have before. And, you know, these kind of things allow us to vicariously communicate in so many ways. So people that see me answering a tweet from a blogger or from just a mom, they probably won't tweet me. But you know what they say? Oh, wow, he'd answer me if I reached out. And they feel the same kind of closeness.
Yeah, and it's funny that you mentioned that because yesterday, to put kind of just exactly what you just said into context, yesterday was my girlfriend's birthday. So we both checked in at the restaurant. The restaurant just tweeted back to the both of us kind of just saying, like, happy birthday. Hope you enjoyed your meal. Now, it's almost about 12 hours later since we've been there, maybe a bit more. But that kind of idea of what a brand is doing, just listening, it gives me an idea of, okay, I liked that place, and now I feel a bit more incentive to return. So they're cultivating relationships right there.
You know, it shows you what the power is. Recently at Collective Bias, we were involved with the Disney Princesses and a company called Lagardère that works with them. And we helped them create an app for the Disney Princesses. The thing's been downloaded 600,000 times, more than any other app they've ever built. And the only way we pushed it out was through our blogger network and moms speaking to moms about a cool thing, about something their kids love to do, not reviewing it, just talking about, oh, you know, it's time to make dinner. You know, thank God my daughter is busy with the Princesses app and trying things on virtually and having fun. And these kind of things, it's just amazing the way they spread. And the beauty of this kind of content is that it's evergreen. It never goes away. People talk about it forever. My daughter's experienced the Princesses. People who are having daughters now are experiencing the Princesses. You know, at some point that might change, but any story about those kind of things live on. And they're us communicating with each other, and they create conversation. So, you know, it's hard for me, but I reach out in many different ways. I've learned to communicate on the platforms people want to communicate with me on. So people will say to me, now my platform of preference overall is probably Twitter. Behind that is probably Facebook. But I'm involved in Instagram, I'm involved in Pinterest, I have a Tumblr page. And what I do is I syndicate all my content to all those places because different people want to absorb that content in different places. If you just write a blog, that's the one place they're going to see it. But if you put it out in other contexts, and it allows me to take the same piece of content I'm putting in one place, put it in other places and create conversation. And then, look, like you said, I pay a lot of attention. I carry an iPhone. I'm always checking it out. I do not get alerts because I have too many followers. But I do look at my phone all the time just to see what's coming in. And then there's, you'll notice, like with anybody else, there's different times of day where I'm more active than others. You know, the first thing in the morning, I'm very active. Late at night, I'm very active. All throughout the day, I tend to stay in touch. But I also, when I'm in a meeting, I'm not picking up my phone and tweeting out. But then again, sometimes I am. John likes to look at me, and he calls it iPhone face. You know, when you're sitting there and other people talking, and you're just like down like this. But that's my job. Communication, being in touch, letting people know that whenever they reach out to me, I'll reach back is part of what I do. So I think everybody can do it in certain ways. Not everybody can do it the same way. And a lot of it also depends on who you are as an individual.
So to kind of go back to what you said early on, almost how you were talking about how certain individuals give lip service to social media. So how do you kind of get in the heads of quote unquote non-believers? Somebody who kind of talks the talk about social media and how the importance of it in social business, but maybe doesn't walk the walk with it. How do you explain the return on relationships to, you know, CEOs and CMOs that maybe aren't doing it already?
Okay, I think there's two different parts of that question. The first part is, if somebody considers themselves an expert and to me isn't really social, I don't try to explain to them. Let them do what they're doing. I might reach out to them. I find that they rarely even read their tweets because I know the things I put in there and I never hear back. So to me, they go on and do what they do. The more important question, I think, that you're asking is, when you're talking to CEOs, CMOs, people involved in companies, how do you get an understanding? Well, first of all, what I do is I'm patient. I build my following. I build my outreach so that people can see that. So, you know, you walk the walk and people will be able to see, like people say to me, well, how did you get such a big following? Or, you know, how did you get so many people to start talking about return on relationship? You must have reached out to people and emailed them and used your database. And I say, no, I just publish a lot. I follow a lot of people on Twitter, so they'll follow me back, but then I give them value. And I make sure that I pump out consistently. I communicate with people. I answer people. I respond to people. When people criticize me, I embrace that criticism. I appreciate it. When people rip me, I embrace that. The only thing I don't embrace is haters. I always tell companies, haters hate. Don't waste your time with them. You know, but critics are valuable. Critics are basically asking a question. They're giving you feedback. So, you know, what I try to do with CEOs and CMOs is, you have to talk their language. You know, if you talk in the typical social language, you talk about retweets, you talk about language they don't understand, you're not going to get anywhere. Talk about loyalty. Talk about trust. Talk about their legacy loyalty program that they either have at the company they're at now, or at one time in career they were really involved in before all the loyalty programs became commoditized, and how valuable they were. Even today, with commodity type loyalty programs, every single CMO can look at his data, or CEO, and see that a person that signed up for their loyalty program is a better customer than a customer that's not. They have a longer lifetime value of a customer. They have a larger average order value. They have more frequency of purchase. Take that and understand how social is a loyalty program on steroids. It gives you the ability to build those relationships, emotionally connect, do something that's important to people every single day. And that's the language I try to talk in. And I try to take those numbers and have them overlay it on what they're doing in the social sphere. So that's one way that, you know, that I try to do it. Number two is, I will try to walk them through these things so they get a better understanding of what's happening there. You know, I will show them the platforms. I will talk about bloggers. Another thing, which is one of my favorite questions, is I think most CMOs are getting much more accustomed with this, but I love when I'm with somebody, whether it's what's scary to me is not how many VPs and CEOs are on social, how many VPs and director level marketing people are not really active in social, are not really understanding the conversations going on there, the learning that's going on there, the research that can be going on there. So what I'll try to do is say to them, you know, look how important bloggers are. And they'll go, well, bloggers aren't that important. You know, I don't know, but I don't know anybody that reads a blog. And I'll go, really? Let's open up your computer and let's go to what you look at every day. Blog, 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 blog. And they're like, no, that's not a blog. Yeah, it is. Most of what they're reading is not the New York Times, is not you know, a high-level media organization. They just think it is because it's so easy to put together a nice piece of work. And then when you look at the ones that are really getting interaction, they're blogs. You know, you go to any of the major media publications' online presences, they don't answer comments. They're above that. They don't even understand the interaction. Yes, they're online. Yes, they might be getting a lot of viewership, but they're not building relationships. They are following the old media model. All they are is old media and a new package. We're in the era right now of new media where it's the age of influence. Anybody can build a brand. Anybody can have influence. Anybody can affect change and can make a difference. And they are every day. So I try to sit and point that out. And then the next thing I'll do, and we're very fortunate at Collective Bias because we've helped all these brands over the last 4 years build huge amounts of content being created by bloggers about their brands. So all we have to do is be sitting in one brand's office and say, hey, let's talk about TCBY. Let's talk about Duane Reade. Let's talk about Glidden. Let's talk about one of any number of clients we've worked with. Let's search their content. Let's go to the images in Google, search for TCBY at Walmart or Duane Reade and some of the products they're selling and see what comes up. And instead of corporate logos and ingredients and pictured maps of the country where people are shopping, you get images, which behind them are links of storytelling, of people talking about things they've done, places they've gone, parties they've had, kids with ice cream on their face, emotionally connected content that takes over the SEO process. So when people search, they're finding content that they can relate to rather than corporate push.
Yeah, getting to the storytelling aspect is so crucial. And it's funny that the day that we're talking, the season 6 premiere of Mad Men came out last night. I don't know if you got the chance to watch it or if you even watch it, Ted. But, you know, every time I get to watch Mad Men, it just kind of reminds me of, like, we're trying to boil down the communication solution. And then once we figure that out, what's the storytelling angle? Because that's going to really get that relationship behind it. So that you touched on that is great.
I was just going to say, truth be told, because I haven't watched Mad Men yet, and John called me last night, John Andrews called me and says, dude,
uh-oh. Well, Ted Rubin seems to have gotten hung up on the other end of the broadcast, so I am going to see if I can't get him back.
Sorry about that. I don't know what
happened.
That's
okay.
I told him that I needed a little relaxation last night, and I was going to put on a movie. He goes, watch the premiere of Mad Men. And I'm like, I was traveling so much last year, I never watched it. So I DVR'd it because I don't want to watch it midway. Because he looked at me, he said, man, this is us. This is back when they were finding a new platform, a new way to do things. And this is what we're doing right now.
It's so poetic.
What I've done is I DVR'd it so I can get the previous seasons or season, whatever it was, and watch it first. So go on. I'm sorry. I just wanted to make sure that was clear because I don't want John to say, hey, why'd you imply on there that you watched that show? You didn't watch it.
No, and I'd also, you know, I never want to assume that anybody's ever watched it simply because they're in the industry. Because I hadn't seen Mad Men until May of last year, I'd been ripped through the first 4 seasons in about a week and a half.
Well, that's what I'm going to do. That's my plan.
Yeah, you'll be hooked. Absolutely.
I've got a few international flights coming up.
There you go. Perfect.
I'm in Singapore and I'm speaking in Australia, so I'm gonna take them with me.
Excellent. So getting to your book, Return on Relationship, and anybody who wants to actually talk about that online, use the hashtag R on R. Simply put, as you have it on your website, so simply put, the value that is accrued by a person or a brand, this is your definition of what Return on Relationship is. Simply put, the value that is accrued by a person or a brand due to nurturing a relationship, ROI is simply dollars and cents. ROR is the value, both perceived and real, that will accrue over time through loyalty, recommendations, and sharing. I think that's a great summation. What kind of brought you to the point of wanting to write this book, Ted?
Well, I have to say that a big part of the influence of this book was when I worked with Seth Godin at Yoyodyne, his company back in 96, 97. I joined it in 97. At the end of 98, Q4 of 98, it was sold to Yahoo. And Seth, while I was there, coined the term permission marketing. The way that happened was he started using it. He wrote an article for Fast Company. The article then became a book, Permission Marketing, which was his first real big blockbuster book in the marketing sphere. Before that, he was writing a lot of self-help books. You know, great stuff, but not in line with what he is doing now. Excuse me. And all of us were indoctrinated with that. You know, that was probably the last company since Collective Bias that I was at that really was a movement and a cause. And we were all there, you know, preaching this new thing called digital. And truth be told, I was the first guy to sell the click-through. Seth developed a product called Get Rich Click. You know, to get an entry in a sweepstakes, you clicked on a banner and it landed you on a landing page. And I would go in front of all the advertising agencies in New York and try to explain to them what the click-through was. And after 40 minutes, they'd say, well, what's the CPM? They couldn't wrap their arms around because no one really understood this. And then even when they started buying them, they didn't understand that you needed to send people to a landing page, a page that told them what you wanted them to do. And Seth preached to us the value of building relationships. It was something that was part of who I was forever. Networking was something I had always done. I've always built relationships in every company I went to. I valued them. I kept connected. I used to keep a date book with everybody's birthday in it. And every December, I'd rewrite it for the next year before we had, you know, what we have today to keep track of those things. And before Facebook ruined it for me and alerts everybody about birthdays. So now I find out kids' birthdays and anniversaries and other things to keep it a little, or try to make it a little more special and don't just write a quick happy birthday on a site. But the value relationships was important. And we learned that it was important to go directly to brands to make them understand and that it was okay to be at a brand who said, we're not going to do this, and to keep getting to know them, because one day either they would change or that employee would leave and go somewhere else. And he would remember, you know, the how much you value the relationship. So it's something I've been thinking about for a long time. As I moved through the space and as I garnered more relationships and as we got more tools to keep in touch with people, you know, whether it be email or texting, I just started really recognizing that a lot of this was being overlooked. People took it for granted. And the way it really came to light was when I was at e.l.f. Cosmetics, eyeslipsface.com. Here was a company that when I joined them was doing about $10 to $12 million a year. They were built with no marketing budget. They were strictly word of mouth. They kind of hit a wall with traditional word of mouth. It was 2008. Social was just starting to scale. I joined them, and a big part of my job was supposed to, you know, be able to make strategic relationships. We had a database when I joined them of about 600,000 email addresses. A guy named Alan Levy, who ran a company called Sell Up, had helped build that list, and then together using social and his skills, we grew that list to 2.4 million people. And I started realizing that the way to go was social, and we jumped into it in a big way. I had a bunch of advantages. I was number one. I was selling a product to women, and quote me on this: there is no social media without women. It ceases to exist. You and I don't communicate that way. We talk at each other. Wait till the other one's done, so the other one can say what we're thinking, and we don't even hear what you're saying. Women communicate very differently. So number one, it was a women's product. Number two, it was cosmetics, aspirational. Women love cosmetics. They love to talk about it. They love to share it. They all become little girls again when they get a bunch of cosmetics in their hands. Now, at number three, it was a family-owned business. So if anything I could do without spending huge media dollars, they were all for, and they just let me do whatever I want, and we had no legal department. So nobody was telling me things I could do and couldn't do. And I got to experiment, which is what I still do today. I learned the lesson that you can try things so quickly in this space and see what catches on. And when it works, I do what I call drive a truck through it. But don't get stuck on it. Keep evolving. Keep listening. Keep seeing what else you can do. Keep doing it as long as it's good. But don't get stuck on that's the only way to go. And we were growing. But even with that, I had a CEO. I had partners who wanted to know, what are you accomplishing? You know, when can we direct message in social? When can we start giving coupon codes? That's all they wanted to do. And I kept saying, this isn't about that. It's about, you know, relationships. And finally, one day I just said, this isn't about return on investment. This is about return on relationship, which will lead to return on investment through trust and loyalty. And they just kind of looked at me, and it made sense to them. And I just kept talking about it. It made sense to a lot of people, and I kept evolving the concept. And, you know, to really simplify the definition you wrote, and I, you know, I have to have a definition for it. But when I try to give it really quickly, I say that ROI is about dollars and cents. ROI is about the people. And if you forget the people, you lose the value of what you're building. Because not only are the people important because they're who you're selling to, but they're the people who can advocate for you, who can evangelize for you, who are going to share your product, and who are going to keep buying it again and again if you build that relationship and they feel that you're looking out for them, that you're doing the right thing, that you're that you have a great product. Of course, remember, none of this is going to help if your product sucks. So obviously that's the most important thing. But again, ROR is part of having a good product. It's listening to people because your product can always get better and you can always fix things. So that's really where it came from. I started using it. Again, I would sit in an office with somebody, with a CEO, and I could say, this is about return on relationship. What does it mean to you, the relationships you built since you got out of college, since you were in college? How valuable were they? Not one of these people will look at you and say that wasn't valuable to them. They would say, that's everything. Then they might ask, well, how do you scale that? And that's another question. But nobody will debate the fact that people like to buy from people they know, like, and trust. And they'll buy more if they do.
Amen. Can't agree more. I got one last question for you. You see a lot of things. You travel a lot of places. As you said, you're flying down to Miami for Hispanicize tomorrow. Ted, what do you see? What's the next big thing? Or is it a thing, or is it a concept? What are you excited about that's next?
Well, first of all, one of the things I like to say is let's not worry too much about what's next, and let's concentrate on what's now. Because I find a lot of people worry too much. I get that in every meeting. Well, we want to be on the next thing. What's next? And I go, well, let's execute what's now. You guys just finished building a worthwhile blog presence or a strong Facebook presence with a great, you know, whether it was a promotion that started it or an engagement. Let's continue on that. That's what, don't just jump to the next thing. So that's the first thing I'd like to say. You know, I'm not really sure what's next. What I think is most important is paying attention, testing out new things. I mean, we tested seeing what we could do with Snapchat. Do I think it has a lot of value to marketers? No. But would I just ignore it because that's my initial feeling? No. Because, again, one of the things that we've learned most importantly, a collective bias, being that we have this community of 1,500 bloggers who are our demographic. We have dads, we have moms, we have Latinas, we have anybody that's in this. We have millennials who are people that are the target audience. So we don't do anything without talking to them. I can't tell you how many meetings I've been with John Andrews, who is a CPG marketer for 15 years before Collective Bias, been in a lot of different companies, will be with a brand. They'll say, well, John, here's what we're doing. What do you think? And he'll look with his little North Carolina drawl, and I don't do too well, but he'll say, why are you asking me? Let's ask our community. Because I'm a 45-year-old male. I'm not buying that shit. Okay? So I think what needs to be next is we've got to put relationships before the sale. I think we've got to start looking people in the eye digitally, because too many people think that clicking a button means you have a friend. And just like you and I right now, we're looking at each other. We're looking each other in the eye. When you're with someone, you're always told, pay attention to them. Don't look around the room. Make sure they know you're concentrating on them. Anybody will tell you how that wins for you, whether it's with your man, with women, vice versa, with clients, with somebody you meet at an event. When you shake their hand, you look them in the eye. You're not just looking at who's walking by next. We need to start doing that digitally, which means looking at people's profiles, having a conversation with them using their name. And I'm going to tell you right now what's the best social marketing book ever written. And it's not anything that most of these people are pitching today. Certainly not my book, although I try to take some things from this book in my book. The best social marketing book ever written was Dale Carnegie, How to Make Friends and Influence People. You want to learn about social? Go back and read that book. Learn about how to make friends, about how to mention people by name, about how the most important word in anybody's book, anybody likes to hear is their name being mentioned, about knowing something about them, about old school sales skills. Before you meet with somebody, knowing what their likes and dislikes are, what their family is like. What excuse do you have today when there's LinkedIn, Facebook, more information than you could possibly garner before a meeting, not to know something about the people that you're talking to? Even during the meeting, you can look down quickly and figure it out. Keep a database with notes when you meet people. Write down how you met them so you remember. I know how you and I were introduced. I will never forget that. It's in my database. If we bump into each other at a conference and I don't remember you by face and you mention your name, I can glance away for a second and come back and know exactly how we met and how we interacted. So I think that I'm not going to say what is next. I'm going to say what I hope to be next. What I hope to be next is people start valuing relationships again the way they used to. Full circle. Back when you walked in the corner store and Mr. Jones said, "How you doing? You know, what's going on today? And you know, by the way, you know that licorice you love? I just got it in." Those are the kind of things that I think need to come next to make this whole social thing come full circle and have real value for companies. And, you know, look, we do our best to do that every day. You know, I get out everywhere I go, everywhere John and I travel, we reach out to people in our community. We reach out via Twitter. We invite people out for drinks. We do everything we can to do to meet people face to face and to get to know them a little bit. And I think that people have to start valuing that again.
Yeah, I love that answer. And basically, the way that I use social is the same way that my boss uses social. If we can get it to the point where we're able to meet someone new and then go and meet them for coffee or drinks or something, that's the beauty of it. And it's probably a relationship you would not have had. And I stress the word relationship that you would not have had otherwise. So I completely am on board with that answer. And I like the idea of not looking at next, but looking at now. So, very cool. Ted, thank you very much for your time. Where can people go to be social with you?
I'm pretty easy to find. It's at Ted Rubin on Twitter, Ted Rubin on Facebook, Ted Rubin on LinkedIn, Ted Rubin on Pinterest, Return on Relationship on Tumblr. And, I mean, just Google me. It'll all come up. But reach out to me anytime. My email address is tedrubin@gmail.com. And if you feel like picking up the phone, and don't forget, you know, best social tool out there is this telephone. You know, don't forget to call people. 917-613-1947.
Yeah, so you called, like I said, you called me like 5 minutes before we went on, and I saw the New York, and I said, well, maybe it's Ted. I had no idea it was you, but I was happy to hear you on the other end of the phone. And you're just as nice a guy, not looking at you face-to-face as you are on the phone.
Well, thanks so much for having me here. Really, really enjoyed it.
Absolutely. Appreciate it. Have a safe flight to Miami. Enjoy everything down in Hispanicize. And to everybody else listening out there or watching, thanks so much for participating in Social Echoes. We'll see you guys next episode. Till then, you can always go to iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and subscribe. You can give us ratings, good, bad, or indifferent. We just want to know how we're doing. Leave us a review. We want to tell us what we can do to give you a greater value with this podcast. Thanks to everybody again. Thanks to Ted Rubin. We'll see you later. Bye-bye.